Wednesday morning, 30th May 1973. We exist physically by virtue of the sun and Mother Earth. The sun represents our inner individuality, our inmost pattern of life, and this inmost pattern of life within us is an expression of the transcendent archetypal energies which are related to the signs of the zodiac. The zodiac is the symbolic representation of the heavenly man, which is a spiritual conception expressing the realization in transcendent awareness of the archetypal man, man in the image of God. The position of the sun in the zodiac indicates the basic ways in which the heavenly man could function through each and every one of us. Most people go through their lives totally oblivious of this. Some of us are sensitive to it, but very few there are who know anything about it. When we talk about this, we necessarily have to use words, descriptive words, which are meaningful for our discriminative consciousness of finite, separate particulars, but hardly so, if at all, for transcendent awareness. This is one of our great difficulties. But if the mind is quiet and open, it can be in touch sensitively with the archetypal forms in which the heavenly man, the transcendent energy, operates through oneself. All our thought process and the manner in which it is conditioned is related to these archetypal forms associated with the zodiacal sign occupied by the sun at the time of our birth. Before we proceed to meditation, I will just briefly retail the characteristics associated with your birth sign, and we will try to use words which are as suggestive as possible and as little misleading as possible. Roughly, remember that each sign is occupied from the 21st of the month to the 21st of the next month. So when I say March, April, it means 21st March to 21st April. It is a little bit difficult if you happen to be right at the turning point, the 21st itself, or the 20th, or the 22nd, because you get the influences of both signs. The sign out of which the sun has come, for instance, if you are born on the 22nd March, or into which the sun is going if you are born, say, on the 19th of March. 19th of March, you would be supposed to be Pisces, but you'd have some influence of Aries also. Well now, March, April, the sign is Aries, and it stands for force, power, that is creation, recreation, or resurrection. Aries represents, in Christian terminology, the Lamb of God. Then comes Taurus, the bull, April, May. Taurus stands for security, for formation, establishment, gravitation. May, June, we have Gemini, the twins, standing for movement and intelligence. June, July, it's more or less the 22nd June to the 22nd or 23rd almost of July, we have the sign of Cancer. It stands for organic life and consciousness. July, August is Leo, which stands for individuality, for incarnation. That is, the incarnation of that transcendence which we may name God or Atma or anything you like. This is man, actually in being now, incarnate deity. Yahweh incarnate, for instance, is represented by Leo. Then, August, September is Virgo, the Virgin, which stands particularly for specialization and for discrimination. Then September, October, Libra, stands for equilibrium, love, culture, and the ideal of happiness. October, November, Scorpio, stands definitely for power and for sex, the play of sex. If the phrase play of sex worries anybody, regard it as the interaction of polarities, which is rather a wider definition. November, December, Sagittarius the Archer stands for revelation, the ideal of truth and right, the sun shining in the unclouded heavens. Then December, January, Capricorn stands for organization, authority, and capital, the use of resources. Aquarius, January, February, stands for cooperation and for civilization. And then Pisces, February, March, stands for commingling. Things begin to lose their definition, their dividing lines, and things begin to coalesce, and the separate personality begins to disappear. Commingling, dissolution. Pisces also stands for the love that unites all manifested life. It stands for sacrifice, in the profound sense of the term, for death as the portal to recreation. And the movement from Pisces into Aries stands for death and resurrection. Now, in your meditative activity, these forces in their archetypal sense are almost impossible to define in words. But the words have to suggest that something which will come through to you if and when, or as and when, that inner sensitivity of the mind can be opened to it. So much for the sun, the source of energy and power which underlies our whole being. Now remember, as I said in the beginning, our physical life is wholly dependent upon the sun and the earth. These, which are archetypal forces from the sun, function through the planet Earth, producing all the life of the earth and all that we see on the earth. Man is an issue from earth's side. The phrase is the late Sir Charles Sherrington's phrase, who was probably the greatest neurophysiologist of our century, a very remarkable man. Man is the issue from Earth's side, totally dependent upon Mother Earth, and of course Father Sun, because all the energies which radiate out to us come from the Sun and sustain the Earth. We are rooted in Earth. The Upanishads say, the earth is the footing of the Lord. We have in the Psalms, the earth is his footstool, the heaven his throne. The earth is his footstool. So now remember, organically we emerge out of earth and are rooted in earth. Earth is the all-containing, all-sustaining, all-nourishing, all-enduring, silent, non-rejecting mother of us all. This earth, the good earth, good in the real sense of the term, the goodness which contains everything, whatsoever happens, and whatsoever we, errant children of Mother Earth, may do. Howsoever we treat Earth, Earth never rejects us. And when our little spark is cinder, silently, uncomplainingly, re-embraces us in her infinite bosom, and there is rest. In terms of earth, we can realize very intensely our wholeness. Our wholeness as individual beings, and our wholeness as integral part and parcel of mankind. Now, we will try a meditation which I think most of you know of. We have done it before. But we will do it now because this is a very opportune moment. You may recall that we used to call this the Earth Meditation. Now just sit very quietly, without any strain in the body. Let the rhythm of the breath, which is the life rhythm, establish itself. Breathing peacefully, let the mind quietly dwell upon all that people in our part of the world are doing. Then extend that eastwards or westwards if you like, till you gradually go round the globe and embrace all mankind in your mind. And you will notice that at this single moment of the earth's life, man goes through his 24-hour day and does almost everything that compasses, that expresses the life of mankind as a whole. Now try and hold that in the mind and realize the total unity with all mankind. And a little later, as you go on, extend that unity to include all the other kingdoms of nature, the whole earth, the sun, the zodiac. Extend it as far as you can. Hold it in your mind and heart with compassion and deep understanding. Let's hold this for just about a quarter of an hour or so. We have considered in some considerable depth the question of the Word, the question of concept and percept, and the part of paramount importance that speech, the Word, and therefore also concepts, play in our life. We have understood something of the limitations imposed upon us by the Word and by concept, by the concept. We must also appreciate, deeply appreciate, the importance of the Word, the indispensability of the Word in the process of our coming to fruition and being and realizing liberation from our state of bondage. Speech is the great integrating power of all our sense experiences. It is the formulator. And as this faculty of speech grows into a better and a better formulating instrument, speech itself releases the conditions and the energy for becoming free of the bondage and the illusions which originate with words and speech. The binder is itself a source of liberation. Without speech, it would be impossible to have a psychomental heritage which we can utilize for our further growth. And there is this wonderful hymn in the Rig Veda to the goddess of speech. I'll read little bits of this hymn. The goddess herself is supposed to be speaking. And she says, I travel with the Rudras and the Vasus, with the Adityas and all gods. We won't go into the meanings of all these things now. But they stand for the various immaterial, superhuman, if you like, beings and for personified forces. I hold aloft both Varuna and Mitra, the great gods. I hold aloft Indra and both the Ashwins. The Ashwins are the twins who are concerned primarily with health and well-being. I cherish and sustain high-swelling Soma, Soma the god of inspiration and the conferrer of immortality, and Twashtar, the artificer of the universe, I support. Pushan, who is the sustainer of life on earth, and Bhaga, the fortunate one, the giver of all happy things. These are the various gods of the Rig Veda. Now, the goddess of speech says that she is the one who upholds them and travels with them. I am the queen, the gatherer up of treasures, most thoughtful, first of those who merit worship. The goddess of speech is that. The word, you see, and what the word embodies. The gods have established me in many places, with many homes to enter and abide in. Through me alone, all eat the food that feeds them. Each man who sees, breathes, hears the word outspoken. They know it not, but yet they dwell beside me. Hear one and all the truth as I declare it. How can you declare the truth? How can you stimulate another but by the use of the word? I verily myself announce and utter the word that gods and men alike shall welcome. I make the man I love exceeding mighty, make him a sage, a rishi, and a Brahman. And the term Brahman here is used in its supreme sense. The Vajrasuchi Upanishad defines the Brahman as he who has realized Brahman. Whatever the caste to which he belongs, whatever his station in life, makes no difference whatsoever. The true Brahman, that Upanishad declares unequivocally, is only he who has realized Brahman. A man born into the Brahman caste as such cannot be called a Brahman. And in this connection, study the last chapter of the Dhammapada. Him I call a Brahman who, so and so, so and so, so and so. That long canto is devoted to the Brahman, and the word the Buddha uses is Brahman. And he says of himself, I am the Brahma become. On the world's summit, I bring forth the Father. The Word brings forth the Father. Very significant. Our concept, our feeling of the Father in heaven idea, and so forth, you see. It's the Word that does it. And this Word is the quintessential distillate of living experience, of sensitivity, which has so blossomed out that it is aware of this transcendent reality to which it can give only the name of Father, the Father. It's the word which brings forth the Father for others, therefore, from him who has realized. So you see the tremendous significance also of the word. Now, I would like to consider together, let us all consider together these jhanas and samapattis that the Buddha constantly mentions in his discourses. Again and again through the discourses, the climax comes with the recital of the different jhanas and the samapattis. Let us see what we might gather about them. The Buddha clearly teaches that when the bhikkhu begins his meditation, he puts aside the five hindrances. The preliminary, of course, is that the body takes the right posture, meaning that position by virtue of which the body will not intrude upon the process of meditation. And he puts aside the five hindrances: thoughts and feelings of lust, second, of malevolence, third, the bhikkhu puts aside all sloth and torpor, fourth, he puts aside worry and flurry, and lastly, he puts aside doubt, vichikiccha. Delightfully onomatopoeic word. Puts aside doubt. We must understand clearly what is implied in this word doubt. The others we fairly well understand. Doubt, sometimes the word perplexity is used. Doubt must not be confused with the free, open-minded, constant investigation, which means that there is no blind faith. Blind faith is always associated with the word which has not been fully understood, and whose meaning, therefore, has not undergone complete purification in one's own mind. That is to say, one has blind faith because the mind is cluttered, it is conditioned. It is not clear seeing, and it is not wholly sensitive, not tuned in such a way that it can receive the whole truth. So the mind must always be open, alert, ready. Not impose its own limited processes upon the whole reality. So the open-minded investigation, which will also imply challenging the ordinarily understood meaning of the teachings, must be present. There are certain things of which there is no doubt. The religious man is he who has quite seen something at least of the true nature of himself, his relationship to the totality, and that towards which he is growing. And he offers no resistance whatsoever in his mind to that movement of life towards fruition. That is the absence of doubt. And that absence of doubt includes also doubt in the reality of the realization of truth, the possibility of it, and the general ways in which this realization can come about. Then that bhikkhu is free from doubt. He has no perplexity about it. His mind is steady then. And with the mind steady and calm, the absence of lust, of malevolence, of worry and flurry, of sloth and torpor, then he can truly meditate. And the meditation as presented by the Buddha starts with applied thought and discursive thought. The two are there together, applied thought and discursive thought with regard to some particular object or subject. Now, this, if satisfactorily carried out, if the mind is properly absorbed in this process, there is at the same time rapture, joy, and equanimity present. There are five elements like that. Now, if the applied thought and discursive thought is of the right nature, it will be calm and it will tend to quieten down. That is to say, thought which is but a stream of words will tend to quieten down. That stream will become utterly peaceful, until finally it need not be there at all. What happens in this process of the quietening down is that all the sense functions remain at peace. We all know from our experience that when we try to pay attention to something which needs attending to, all the different sense impressions, the sense consciousnesses, as we call them, all start up and make a big noise. The sights, the sounds, tunes will come and obsess the mind, or pictures of what happened. Day before yesterday's dinner party will suddenly interfere with paying attention to the thought of the Buddha, or something like that, and so forth. All the sense functions interfere. They are noisy. They are superficial disturbances of the mind. When all these disturbances stop, then that applied thought and discursive thought also quietens down, becomes perfectly peaceful, disappears, and the mind on its own plane is sensitive to this indescribable reality of that to which it has paid attention. You see, this is the extraordinary part of, we will use the word thought, although it's not quite the right word, of thought in meditation. That the formal, the particular shaped thought gives place to thinking, which is formless, shapeless, but which completely absorbs the reality of that to which you are attending. You see why all the mystics of the world, all the yogis, all those who have realized these deep things of the mind and released these extraordinary powers of the mind have never spoken about it, have never written about it, because you can't speak and write about it objectively, which means definitively. The essence is the undefined part, and the undefinable part. It's the essence. The appearance is the defined part, the talkable part. So that what we call the second stage is one in which there is this sort of indescribable, indefinable activity of the mind, together with rapture, with joy, and with equanimity. In the third stage, the rapture comes to rest completely, because that rapture can be and is a slightly disturbing element. And there is a state of calm peace only. And in the fourth jhana, as it is called, the fourth stage, there is only the perfect equanimity, the mind in complete union. Not with any object of thought now, because the objectivity of that to which you paid attention at the start has vanished with the cessation of the flow of words and thought. You appreciate how difficult it is to attempt descriptions of this. Now, we must not make the mistake of imagining that these are four different stages like rungs on a ladder or anything like that. It is, I think, a little bit simpler to regard them as different intensities of awareness. Or if you like to use the which is not a very good simile, but it's the one which comes to my mind, if you like to regard it like a swimmer who is not just swimming on the surface, but who sort of goes a little deeper into the water and swims, perhaps still deeper into the water and swims, and so on. Something like that. Different depths of awareness. I mean, all these phrases have their misleading aspect. But if it stirs up that something in your own mind, well, your own mind will know. It is a one thing. It is not composed of specifically separable elements. It is a one thing. Now, why is it a one thing? This we can certainly grasp intellectually. When the sense functions become pacified, and all the disturbances, the superficial disturbances stop, the mind becomes unified. Otherwise, it is fragmentary. The particular sense consciousness imposes itself upon the mind, and everything is seen in that partial light, whether it be the sight consciousness or the hearing consciousness or the touch consciousness or whatever it is. There is a fragmentary apprehending of the reality, not a total apprehending of it. When the sense functions are completely pacified, do remember, I'm very, very keen upon this word pacified, not suppressed or repressed, as so often translated. The Sanskrit word used is the state of ekagrata. Ekagrata, made one, is its true meaning. They call it one-pointed. But I think one-pointed brings in the element of exclusion of this, that, or the other. The moment you get exclusion of this, that, or the other, you have entered the realm of separation, not of wholeness. You've gone away from the wholeness. This whole awareness has no exclusion in it. So you see, what happens is that the mind becomes unified. And do remember that in this state, just for convenience, I use the phrase, the mind becomes unified, actually the mind-body unification is total. That mind-body unification is symbolized in the posture. You see, here, this earth, the sun and the solar system and the zodiac. You, this man on earth, are now inseparable from that man, the heavenly man. You here dealing with forces which are separable and distinct, whether they be psychological or whether they be physical forces, are now in complete union with the one great transcendent energy which is manifest to us in some way or other as great archetypal forms. So you see, the unification is complete. And this means that the evil state, the state of suffering, of dukkha, of being far from the infinite, of being divorced from the totality, is out. I and the Father are one. Jesus affirms that. And the Buddha talks of that shunyata phala samadhi in which I constantly abide. So now, this which for verbal statement purposes is talked of as four jhanas is all one jhana. It's one living process. We've got so accustomed to analyze and to split up. That has been the conditioning of the human race right from the beginning of time, that we do not appreciate the real meaning of our livingness. I've said, well, you've heard me say again and again, that the living process of the body is a whole process. Nothing ever stops, all 24 hours. The heart, the lungs, the blood goes on perpetually, all in a togetherness. And when that togetherness is the perfect teamwork, the perfect togetherness, we are healthy. We feel fine, as we say in simple language. And yesterday I spoke about the maturity of the mind, didn't I? The maturity of the mind means this state of the mind. And it does not imply that in the mature state, the whole state, It is unable any more to deal with the particular, not at all. It is able to take in each and every particular in right relationship to its own wholeness and within its own wholeness. You see why the holy ones have been venerated and worshipped through the ages. This is the meaning of holiness. So now, these four jhanas really are varying degrees of intensity of, it's a strange phrase to use, but I'll use it. It's a bad phrase. Degrees of perfection of the wholeness. You can't have degrees of perfection. Perfection is absolute. But you understand what I mean. So much for the jhanas. Now it's very interesting to note that when the Buddha talks about looking back into his past conditions, the jatis, I'm not going to use the word his past lives, which is nonsensical. His past conditions, the limited bound states, he does this in the state of the fourth jhana. And he sees all his past habitations. Pubbe nivasa. Nivasa is habitation. Pubbe is past. He looks into all his pubbe nivasa, past habitations. And if you read the description as given in the texts, it's a little bit naive and childish and just not worth the ink and the paper. I was born in such and such a family, such and such a clan, such were the clothes I wore, such was the food I ate. Well, who on earth is interested in that part of the recital? Would you ever get a publisher to publish a book which detailed your past lives in that fashion? And do you think that a Buddha, in that transcendent state of wholeness, is going to be concerned with what he ate and what clothes he wore and what clan he belonged to or what sort of hut he lived in? Perfectly absurd. The pubbe nivasa are the past states of mind and consciousness. In our own day and age, experimental psychological work has gone forward to a considerable degree. By association, you go backwards in time. At this moment, I was aware and I'm thinking and speaking, etc., in this manner. Previous to that, it was that. Previous to that, it was that. Thus you see and understand the mechanics, the science of the living process of the mind and the transformations that take place. Because the whole task of freedom from dukkha is the healing of the mind. It is this which he was looking into here now, in this life. So that he really understood. These are the pubbe nivasa, the past habitations of awareness. To put it in a better form, the movement of awareness, which is a constant reality through space and time, as manifested in an individual being. And it is in the fourth jhana when discursive thought, has ceased altogether, which means all form-making has ceased. You are in a formless realm. You are in a realm of consciousness. You are in a realm of consciousness where there are no limitations, where you are functioning in terms of wholeness. Then how can you talk of this particular family, this particular clan, these clothes and that food? You see? He never says punarjanma as the Hindus do. He says pubbe nivasa, and he talks of the moving process of life as punabhava, and again becoming. But whatsoever be the form in which the becoming is displayed, here and now in space and time, that becoming is the resultant of all the conditioning forces which bring it into being. And the conditioning forces themselves are undergoing transformation. This word punabhava is hopelessly mistranslated. Punabhava is also the word used which is translated as the succession of lives and so forth. The becoming process is a transforming one process. Don't forget that. So we must understand these things clearly. But in the fourth jhana, he observes the movement of awareness and the changing mental states in order to understand them to the full. Now here is a point which we must bear in mind carefully. He is the perfected Holy One. His is the psyche which is utterly purified. And that psychology of which he is master is the psychology of the liberated, totally purified one. And the psychology of the becoming states of the psyche through time and space, which he looks into, was his own psychology as the still not perfected one. But you see, it is this power, this ability, which gives the enlightened one the power to be the perfect mind healer. If you look through the discourses at the descriptions which are given of what the Buddha is, when Kacchana, one of his great disciples, speaks of him, speaks in exalted terms. You can read them for yourselves. By observing all the pubbe nivasas, the former habitations, with the utterly purified mind, the Buddha clearly understands the meaning and the process of punabhava, the becoming process, which of course represents samsara, usually called the cycle of births and deaths, but it is better to regard it as the cycle of conditioned states as it arises and functions here in our everyday life. In other words, he fully understands what we call the karmic process at the psychophysical level, at the level of the existent, of the finite and mortal. karma in the transcendent, at the transcendent level, is just pure creation. It is a-causal. It is consequenceless. Causality doesn't hold at all there. The sense of causality which we have is simply due to our being constricted or restricted to functioning in terms of space and time. But an enlightened one is fully awake to the transcendent as well as the finite aspect of karma and the karmic process. And the enlightened one sees the complete relationship of the finite mortal process to the infinite, immortal, perpetually creative activity. Since that is beyond all speech, he doesn't say anything about it. At least as far as the written records go. Understanding the karmic process then, here now within our sphere of samsara, of mortality, is able to see quite clearly with his mind, as he says, the mind and nature of any person. He sees at once. If I sit in his presence, he'll know all about me. If he merely directs his mind when he enters the deep jhanas to me, the existent, he knows all about me without my physical presence. There are lots of wonderful things that the holy ones can do, helping people at a distance and so forth, knowing what their needs are. You know the saying, it is said that when he woke up in the morning, he looked at the world with the eye of a Buddha. And seeing such and such a one in distress, he sent help. We mustn't imagine, therefore, that a person who had embezzled the funds of his firm and was in terrible distress was going to be helped by the Buddha. Not at all. Nothing of that. He helped the one whose mind was in distress because of the inability to emerge out of some tangled condition. That primarily is what he helped. And having these powers, he was able to see. And remember always that he enters jhana, deep jhana, in order to see this as it is written. He was also enabled to know precisely how beings change from moment to moment. And this whole activity, this process, the Punnabhava process, is the manifestation of karmic law, as we call it. So much then for that state which we talk of as the fourth jhana. One other point in connection with it, there is still self-consciousness present. The next is described as follows. With the going down of all sensory perception and with the complete disappearance of all states of joy or sorrow, he enters upon and abides in the state of infinite akasha. Now bear in mind Akasha is always translated as space. I haven't come across anyone who has translated it as mind space. But Akasha really is mind space. Akasha is mind space. And if mind space hadn't its archetypal reality, space in the ordinary sense as we are aware of it in our physical existence wouldn't be there for us. All these sort of fundamental forms of consciousness and existence here at the psychophysical, the mortal level, have their roots in the archetypal, in that which is not born nor dies. Now, with the going down, therefore, of all sensory perception, he enters upon and abides in the state of infinite Akasha, this mind space, which has no finitude attached to it, no particularity at all. And this state, as far as the written records go, is said to be followed by, but there is no following, there is no time element here, by the infinity of vijnana, consciousness. I take responsibility for adding this to it. It's not in the texts. This vijnana is not vijnana in the simple sense of discriminative consciousness, that which discriminates the chair from the carpet and so on and so on. Not that consciousness. It is what the Buddha called the vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato bhavam. The consciousness which is without characteristics, in other words, infinite, non-descript, anantam, endless, beginningless therefore, eternal, sabbato, everywhere, accessible or shining. Pure consciousness in all the Indian scriptures has always been called the light. The light unto itself, of itself, the self-existent light. That's how they have described consciousness. And here, of course, the Upanishads have an advantage in that they use the term Atma, a separate term, to denote the non-discriminative consciousness, the pure absolute consciousness, as they call it, Atma. You see, he enters upon and abides in this state. Now, for the purposes of writing, obviously, what can you say but he enters upon? But there is no he. When that state of the fourth jhana intensifies and becomes completely transparent and lucid, the distinction between self and not self has at last been utterly overpassed. There are no barriers whatsoever. This is a real meaning of the term cosmic consciousness. It might be better to call it cosmic awareness, which does not mean awareness of the manifested universe as so many particulars, and sort of your consciousness being a super bag which holds all the particulars within the purview of its immediate perception. Not that at all. See, particularity has disappeared. The finite, whilst you are alive and awake here and now, has gone through this extraordinary portal of death, the death of the finite, which means the transformation of finitude in your awareness into non-finitude. All limitations, all barriers are out. What is called you, the organism, the person sitting there, this psychophysical organism sitting there, is then like a, shall we say, like a lens which focuses the light of the sun. And a lens so perfect that the lens itself is invisible, intangible. It's pure light. You are transformed into light. But if you are transformed into light, your separate individuality has completely gone beyond all separation. These are real, real experiencings. Otherwise, the record of them would never have survived through the centuries. What survives in scripture as valid throughout the centuries is due to the immortality of its inherent truth. It is for us to try and understand these things. Now consider, Akasha is the container, Vijnana is the contained. Contained and container are an identity. And in this state of identity, all the archetypal forces, the transcendent energies which we call love, wisdom, etc., are in perfect operation. If there is no separation whatsoever between you and me in that state of awareness, if you are in that state of awareness, from you there flow out love, wisdom, beauty, everything, all the time. A powerful healing influence. You know, this is symbolically represented, hinted at, in some of the discourses, when it is said that if the Buddha or the great Arahats, the perfected ones of his disciples, are in a woodland, that woodland is lighted up by their presence. Well, obviously, if you and I were there, we wouldn't see sort of bright, wonderful, bright flashing lights about, you see. No circus performance goes on. But this is its true meaning. It is a symbolical way of talking, that the woodland is lighted up. But what you and I can experience as a reality, as people did, for instance, in the presence of Ramana Maharishi in India, in our own century, what you and I can experience is that extraordinarily transformed atmosphere. We come perplexed, in difficulty, in trouble, or out of curiosity, or whatever it is, with all sorts of conditioned states within our own mind, and in the presence of the Holy One, something happens. A mystery. There is peace. There is no confusion, no darkness. The pain of the body, the sorrow of the heart, just seem to vanish in that presence. The impurity in the mind undergoes complete transformation in his presence. This I too know for a fact out of experience. both myself in relation to the other and others in relation to me. This is a real thing that happens. And it is this influence which is the influence of the immeasurable, the formless, the utterly pure. In this state, then, one knows, one really knows the meaning of love. The love which is utterly incorruptible. And if that is a realized thing, then that Holy One can never be seduced, corrupted, tempted at all. Not only that, but His presence transforms the other. I never forget that marvelous scene in that film, D.W. Griffith's King of Kings. Mary Magdalene comes along to meet Jesus with her purposes in her heart. And he looks at her, and she looks at him, and the sinner is changed into the saint. The devotee of the Son of God. See, it is this sort of thing that is implied in this entry into the planes of infinite akasha and infinite vijnana. What happens to your own psyche and psychical functioning? Because from that state one returns back to normal sense discursive mind functioning in the world. You have to move about, you have to eat, etc., etc. What happens to the psyche itself? All its conditioning is completely out. There is no taint whatsoever in it. Now remember, psyche in the Greek myth is the daughter of a mortal king and queen. And because she was so beautiful, the people began to worship her and to neglect Aphrodite. So she gets somewhat piqued and tells her son Eros, use your bow and arrow on that girl at a time when she will wake and see an ugly fellow and fall in love instantly with him. Well, you know the myth. Eros goes, but he himself gets enraptured with Psyche. So he doesn't fulfill his mother's behest. He comes every night, but on condition that Psyche never tries to see him, never tries to find out who he is. Being mortal and frail, she is unable to do this. Her sisters poison her mind and say, is a terribly ugly, awful person who comes and loves you every night. You see, the night typifying the unconscious. In the dark, the seed germinates, comes to fruition, always in the dark. So, finally, she sees him, and Eros, the immortal, goes away. Psyche goes through years of tribulation, sorrow, and so on. And at last the story ends with Psyche and Eros meet again, and their marriage is celebrated. But the gods in heaven cannot have a mortal as the bride of Eros in permanency. So they confer immortality upon Psyche. Now you see how our psyche, which is our particular mind pattern, born of the fertilization of the body itself by transcendent mind. Our psyche, the mortal, the imperfect, when completely and utterly purified, lives in timeless conjugation with Eros, creative love itself. This is the state of utter purity, the state of chastity in the supreme sense. This is one of the meanings, there are several meanings, this is one of the meanings of the marriage made in heaven. That person is incorruptible, and in his presence, those who are corruptible experience the reality of incorruptibility. There is so much one could say, perhaps, about these samapattis, as they are called. After the fourth jhana, this entering into infinite akasha and vijnana is called entering into the samapattis, first, the second. But it's not wise to talk too much about it. Then one enters and abides in the plane of no thing. It's usually printed nothing. And the text actually says, one sees that here is nothing. You see how contradictory the terms are. The moment you try to use language for the untalkable, it becomes very difficult to escape using self-contradictory phrases. How can you see nothing? It is because you do not see anything that you logically deduce and state, there is nothing here. See the tricks of the mind? Here is nothing. No thing. But there's no such thing as vacuity anywhere. Absolute vacuity. Akasha, the container, is difficulty of language again. Chock-a-block full of the plenitude. There's not a chink anywhere. And that plenitude is totally transparent, totally elastic, totally unresisting. Here is no thing. What is no thing? As put in the Kabbalah, the Zohar particularly, the mystical no thing. This mystical no thing is the farthest limit to which the human can go in approaching transcendence. Beyond is the absolutely transcendent, quite outside human reach. That is that no thing, which is the well of creative energy, if you like. And in that state of awareness, all perception or non-perception is totally non-existent. Hence, they talk of that samapatti, the fourth one, as neither perception nor non-perception. We must not make the mistake of thinking of the word perception in our sense, seeing, hearing, touching, experiencing by the use of discriminative consciousness, or playing with the concepts of the mind and logically deducing and perceiving this, that and the other, as we say it. not that perception at all. Remember that the mind here has become completely unified. There is no distinction between the conscious mind and the unconscious mind and all that sort of stuff. There is no such thing as a distinction of the nature of my mind and your mind. It is the one universal reality, completely lighted up through you and in you. The light in the darkness. And now the darkness fully comprehends that light. And the Buddha made still another statement, as if this wasn't difficult enough, you see. He made still another statement. The final stage, the ninth one, which is the complete cessation of all perception and feeling. Now the word feeling has been used. We know our definition of the word feeling. But perhaps the word feeling in that context may mean something like this. I have talked of the inner sensitivity of the mind, which we must allow to emerge and grow. That inner sensitivity, I have to use the word sensing, but it has nothing to do with our senses of sight, sound, etc. That inner sensitivity senses what is realized in these profound samapattis. And remember, the word samapatti means coalescence, the disappearance of all particularity. It's a coalescence into primordial oneness. This sensitivity, sensing transcendence, ceases to do it. And that the Buddha called touching nirvana with the body. It's an extraordinary phrase. Recollect that in all the jhanas, and the samapattis of course also, he talks of the body itself becomes completely suffused with ease. With ease. That's the word he uses all the time. It sounds as if, well, I mean, it's like going to one of these modern hydros and so forth and having a Turkish bath and you're in a state of ease. Nothing of that sort. It's suffused with ease all the time. And ease, as we know in our dualistic terms, is the other dual of ease, isn't it? Of dis-ease. See, ease and dis-ease. But if the whole body itself, the whole being is suffused with ease, dis-ease, dukkha, is no more. You touch nirvana with the body. See, this is the Buddhist presentation is, as far as I'm aware, one of the most complete psychological presentations. It is in psychological form because that is the only form in which you can put it, of these transcendent states of awareness. Now, most scholars and some very distinguished scholars have talked of these jhanas and samapatis as states of trance. Dismiss that word trance. That's not a good word to use in this context. These are states of realized communion, right up to the supreme state of communion possible to man. And this means the true unification with totality, or the merging into totality. All differentiation is out. It is the fulfilled unio mystica of the mystic. You remember that passage in St. John, 16th chapter, I think it comes, and Jesus says, "And now I am no more in the world, and I come to thee." Most significant statement. The Hindus called it the Asampranyata Samadhi. The Samadhi, the communion in which it is not a case of thou and I in union, in harmony. There is only the one reality. Call it thou if you like, call it I if you like. Either word is equally meaningful and equally meaningless. It's meaningless insofar as the word thou or I indicates separateness. Thou is separate from I is separate from thou. See, they called it the Asampranyata Samadhi. There is no thou, there is no I. It is the total fulfillment. Now, the Upanishads present all this in four groups only. They call them the avasthas, the states. There are four states, they say. The waking state, the dreaming state, the dreamless slumber state, and the fourth, which is called the turiya, which simply means fourth. The turiya state. Sometimes they use the word chaturtha, you see, which also means fourth. The fourth state. And that fourth state is the supreme transcendent state, the state of the Asampranyata Samadhi. It is useful to see what the Varaha Upanishad, which is another one of the very great yoga Upanishads, says on this matter. Although strictly the classification is in four broad states, they talk of it in various ways and introduce what they call several stages, seven stages, or whatever classification they are pleased to make. Just as the Upanishads with the different chakras, the centers, you know, through the body, starting with the base of the spine up to here, talk of seven centers. They even talk of 12 centers. I can show you here in Upanishad, in one of the Upanishads, where they talk of the Dvadasanta, the 12th center. There are six up to here, Ajna, between the eyebrows, and six others in the brain itself. It's very interesting, that balancing of those six with all the rest. See, because here you are free of the realm of the finite and the mortal. This is all symbolic, of course. But as far as the non-finite is concerned, the immortal, there too, in order to express the different manifestations of the realizing of infinitude, they split it up into six centers. Now here in the Varaha they talk of seven stages, you see, and it starts off, the three stages, the first three, are said to be attained with or amidst differences and non-differences. This is a correspondent of the applied thought and discursive thought of the first jhana in the Buddhist teachings. The universe one sees in the waking state, the meditator thinks to be really existent. When the mind is firmly fixed on the non-dual one and the conception of duality is put down, put aside, then he sees this universe as a dream. Through his union with the fourth stage, not to be mixed with the fourth avastha, the fourth state, which is the transcendent, with the fourth stage, as the autumnal cloud being dispersed vanishes, so this universe, he uses the word perishes, vanishes really. O Nidaga, Nidaga is the disciple who has asked the teacher to expound. Be convinced that such a person has only sattva remaining. And the word sattva means truth, being, total being. Then, having ascended the fifth stage, called Sushuptipada, dreamless sleeping, he remains simply in the non-dual state, being freed from all differences. Having always inward vision, though ever participating in external actions, those that are engaged in the practice of this, the sixth stage, are seen like one sleeping when fatigued. Lastly, the seventh stage, which is the ancient, and that which is called the Gudashupti, which literally means the secret sleep. Guda is secret. You see? The secret sleep is generally attained. Then one remains in that secondless state, the completely non-dual, unified state. There is no second there. In the secondless state, without fear, the last thing to disappear. Pride is the last thing to disappear in the mysticisms of the world. Because the mysticisms of the world, insofar as they accept the personal God idea, stop short of these transcendent modes of awareness. And with his consciousness almost annihilated, where there is neither being nor non-being, neither self nor not-self, like an empty pot in akasha, there is void both within and without. Like a filled vessel in the midst of an ocean, he is full both within and without. Do not become either the knower or the known. May you become the reality which remains after all thoughts are given up. Having discarded all distinctions of the seer, the sight, and the seen with their affinities, meditate solely upon Atma, which shines as the supreme light.